All right. Good afternoon. Welcome back. Those on the live stream as well, welcome back. In this part, we're going to talk about Azure infrastructure now. For those of you here on site, you will have more time for the labs to continue afterwards. But now let's talk about Azure infrastructure. In our agenda, what we're going to see is we're going to look at the fundamentals of Azure infrastructure. And you might be surprised to see what actually is Azure in total. It's a little bit more than most people know or think. But we are going to focus for the remainder of this afternoon specifically on compute, storage, networking, and on Azure Resource Manager. And Azure Resource Manager is something completely new. The way we have always deployed virtual machines or resources in Azure has always been into the classic model. Today, something new exists, which is called the Resource Manager, and it changes the way you do your deployments. And that's rather important. But again, it comes back to this, which we talked about this morning. This is Microsoft's vision in the long run, and that's where they're working on. Whether you're Azure, whether it's a service provider, whether it's your on-premises data center, you should be able to move workloads, applications, data, whatever, between those as much as possible. That does, of course, mean that if you deploy something here, you need to be able to pick it up and put it here or here or wherever you want to pick it. So because of that, you will see a lot of changes. And you will also see that if you're going to think about it, the way you are going to deploy something in Azure is rather the same as the way Microsoft wants you to deploy new resources with Windows Server 2016. Now in the beginning, again, this is like nano server, like anything else, rather confusing. But it's that mind shift that you need to make to yourself again. I'm not deploying a server, I'm deploying resources. And we'll go back to that one more in depth. Just looking at some fundamentals, this is Azure today. As you can see, we've got infrastructure services, we've got compute, we've got storage, we've got some networking, load balancing, and this is probably what most people know. And then probably other ones know as well, we've got some Office 365 somewhere and those kind of things. If you just look at all of the other things they offer in that cloud, media services for streaming. For example, if you look at Netflix, they're not running on Azure, they're running on the competition. But in the end, what they do is they use media services. They don't use a virtual machine or a container. It's completely different. They've got site recovery, which is if you want to work and replicate your virtual machines to Azure, and in case something goes wrong on premises, you can start it up in Azure. That is perfectly possible. You got backup as well. You got Active Directory. A lot of people are scared about Active Directory in Azure, but it's perfectly possible to have your Active Directory on-premises connected to an Active Directory on Azure and take advantage of the both worlds. Now, this one has quite some advantages. You can check where the people are logging in. For example, one of the demos that I sometimes give at events is I log in with my user account where I am, and then I let a colleague log in from Russia with my credentials. Okay, it's a fake account, it's not my real account, but still. And what happens is that Azure will see, Azure Active Directory will see, how is this possible? He's in Barcelona 1 minute, and 15 minutes later, he's in Russia logging in. It's not possible that he can cross that distance in 15 minutes through RDP, yeah. But this is one of the advantages that Azure Active Directory has. On the other hand, there's still a lot of advantages you have to on-premises as well. But you combine both, and you can make sure that they work together. This one, for example, has a free way of letting end users reset their own passwords. You can do that with your on-premises Active Directory as well, but it's going to cost you new software, new infrastructure, and a lot of pain to get it implemented. And you can see there are way too much, and literally every month this will grow. Probably the slide I show you now is already out of date because it goes so fast in new services. So what are we going to look at? We're going to look at a few things, and that's everything which has to do with networking, storage, compute, but a little bit also about the marketplace and the virtual machine image gallery and the virtual machine depot. The Virtual Machine Depot, for those of you who don't know it, it's actually more coming from the open source world. And there are a lot of images in there where you can deploy a workload, a predefined, ready-made workload. The only thing left you have to do is fill in a name and some configuration. The best example might be WordPress running on a flavor of Ubuntu or something like that. You literally can use it from that depot and start it up into Azure. The store or the marketplace is where most third-party vendors will put in their application. Now, those are two things, of course, you can't use yet today on-premises. But even that, and we'll come back to that one, you're going to see integrated on-premises as well. All right, let's have a quick look at that infrastructure that they're running, because this is nice, but especially these people sometimes say, how can we compete with Azure? And why do they say that? Because of this. Oops. This is the amount of Azure regions that exist today. Forget about quickly AWS and Google Cloud combined, that I don't mind whether we like it or not, at least Microsoft doesn't like it. AWS is still way bigger. But they have less regions, especially from a point of view where I want my region as close to myself, that is rather important. That was not the idea. Here we go. If you look at all of the fibers that they're running, that's rather heavy. If you ever have the chance to visit one of these data centers in Ireland, it's possible, through some sort of partner program. Don't know exactly how it works, but you can do a visit. It's amazing. Just to seeing that, that's like, okay, I've got my own data center and you've got this. Why am I even trying to build something? The way they do it is fantastic. But they are rather smart data centers that they built and all interconnected to each other. Another thing you can use and which you have to take into account if you're going to use this type of services is ExpressRoute. And what ExpressRoute does is if you're too far away from a data center of Azure, it might be that your VPN or your speed to that data center is not that good. Not enough, at least, to run services over there, run services with you, and have them talk to each other. ExpressRoute is something which is, as you can see, mostly offered by telecom providers that will make you connect more local to your data center, and they have direct connections into Azure, which means the speed, the latency is less, and so on. Hybrid, I told you, Microsoft's vision is for that three things. So hybrid cloud, meaning private and public. Now, service provider, by the way, is also public. So those two are the public ones. And what we see in the organizations, this comes from IDC, you can't read it here, but it's IDC, Gartner, and you know, these guys that write these reports where we pay a lot of money for. And we see that most enterprises are looking at a combination of the two. Why is that? There are many reasons. Do you today already want to put your data into Azure without having it on premises anymore? That's a big question many companies have, and most will say no. What we do see is that new enterprises that specifically built their solutions for this type are the only ones that can go full here or full here. But traditional enterprises today, they're just not ready for it. That being said, does that mean you have to ignore Azure today? If you look at it from a production point of view, you're probably going to say, I can't really put a lot today into Azure. But you can look at it from other points of view. For example, something I was not capable of a couple of years ago, I can do now. One of the things I normally should do all the time is when I do some upgrades or updates, is test it first in a lab environment. My boss doesn't give me enough resources to build a lab environment that's equal to my production environment. So what I basically do is I use an export, I use a snapshot, I use a backup, I use whatever you want to from the day before from that production environment, and I start it here for a couple of days, try the patch, and afterwards I kill it. Because they have way enough resources. And there are many more use cases you can think of that can make your life a little bit more easier on your day-to-day work without actually starting to move production environments to there. So this is their vision they have today. So if you're going to look at hybrid, if you look at Azure Storage, they want to combine it with Store Simple. Store Simple is a box, which I think isn't that cheap, although some people get them for free, which will get your data, and everything which is cold data or old data will be automatically tiered and archived to Azure Storage. For backup, you got Azure Backup and Site Recovery. SQL Server, you can actually run your SQL Server databases right here and have one or two of those copies in Azure, which means you will be able to run some websites right here with that storage, with that database, while all of your production data is still on premises. That exists. For pure from an infrastructure point, they are going to release Azure Stack. Azure Stack now in preview. Don't run it yet. It's got some issues for now, but they're working on it. But Azure Stack will actually give you exactly the same look and feel as Azure, the new portal. I'll come back to that one in a few seconds. But the idea behind it is that you're going to deploy, manage, and so on your virtual machines exactly the same way as you would do here and as they would do here. That should be out, Azure Stack, more or less, you know, probably a couple of months after the release of Windows Server 2016. Is this the same as Windows Azure Pack? You might have heard of that one. No, it's completely new. Windows Azure Pack can be looked at as the V1 in Azure, and Azure Stack is the V2. If you think today and you want to do something, my advice would be don't look at Windows Azure Pack anymore. Just go for the stack directly. You got application integration, you got identity with Active Directory going to your own directory. You got cloud management, which means if you are using OMS in the cloud, you will be able to combine it with your system center on premises and then use the data of both. And then for connectivity, you use virtual private networks. And if necessary, you're going to combine it with that express route to for the latency and the speed. Talking of Azure Stack, this is the idea, purely platform. If you're going to look at Azure, and actually, let me just show you this instead of this slide. That was not what I want to show you. Where's my mouse? Here we go. This is the old portal. This is the old portal of Azure where you used to deploy your virtual machines. This is the V1, the classic model. Yeah? I'm going to come back between the differences between V1 and V2, but there is now this check out the new portal, launch. You can reach it directly also, portal.azure.com. And this is the new look and feel. And here is where we're actually going to work with Azure Resource Manager and V2 virtual machines. Now, Azure Stack is going to give you exact same website, exact same look and feel, but there will be differences. As you can see, I've got a lot of icons here on the left. They will have less, and they will always be a little bit behind. But the first idea they're bringing is that compute, that storage, that networking on premises as well. Same way of working, same way of automation, same way of deploying to make it consistent. One of the things with Windows Azure Pack previous version was that you needed to use System Center and specifically Virtual Machine Manager. Unfortunately for Microsoft, Virtual Machine Manager isn't that popular besides in the US. That's why Azure Stack won't need it. It will give you some advantages, but you won't need it. You can do everything through PowerShell. So that means the only thing you're going to need is Windows Server, Hyper-V, and then a layer on top of that that is called Azure Stack. As of today, it requires 128 gigabytes of RAM just to deploy that layer. That means you haven't deployed a single virtual machine. So it's basically already one full host that you lose just for the layer. Yeah. There are some tricks in cheating in the scripts that use the deployment to get it back to 32, but it doesn't work that well. We'll see how much more work they can do to change that or to distribute it. That's also why I said, if you don't have the time and don't want to investigate, if you start today with Azure Stack, that entire stack needs to be deployed on one host. So unless you've got a host with enough memory that you can use for some testing, you probably don't even get it started. They will be able to split up these roles in the future by GA, but today everything runs on the same box, which isn't that handy. I mean, I don't have that amount of RAM, unfortunately. If you're looking at what type of applications are running in the cloud, and I can actually talk about Microsoft and Amazon and Google as well. More than 50% is not even correct. I would say more than 70% is actually dev test. They probably won't like to say it, but there's not that much production in those clouds, not even on the biggest one today. What we do see is that some of these vendors, like the Netflix, for example, has that cloud native app specifically built for that. Yes, they're running entirely on there. But there's not that many production environments already. On the other hand, dev test, backup disaster recovery, and then lift and shift packaged apps, meaning I run my SQL server here, and a workload here, and a website here, and maybe even a website here as well. And those combinations that you do see more and more. But again, most of the time, they want the data still right here for management reasons, for compliance reasons, for whatever else reason you can imagine. That being said, it is growing. On a yearly basis, you see more and more and more people using it. But then, of course, the big question is, can I trust that cloud? I think we all heard the horror stories of a certain three-letter word in the US that likes to steal all your data and actually asks to those large companies, give me just the backdoor key. Luckily for us, all of these vendors are fighting against them. And one of the things that they, of course, do is, if your resources are not running in a US cloud, then the three letters need to ask the other country for access. And the other countries will say, that's nice, but that's the owner. You have to go through the judges, you have to go through the courts, and so on. The only thing Microsoft can do if they force you is give them raw data. Raw data means unencrypted. Sorry, encrypted, the other way around. And they have nothing at that point in time. But do keep in mind, especially for that, if you're deploying your virtual machines, know where you're deploying it and know that your enterprise supports that. I'm not 100% certain anymore how it is with the Belgian law, because you have the European law now as well. But I do know, for example, people that work in law enforcement, they are not allowed to deploy something on a service provider outside of Belgium, which means for them, Azure is basically a no-go, because there's no Azure data center in Belgium, right? So make sure you check that up front, because it depends on the vertical where you're allowed to store. Now for the trustworthy, get about this one. Yeah, I like this slide. So Microsoft says they have 1 billion plus customers supported by Microsoft Cloud Infrastructure. They're actually not even lying. But Xbox is running in Azure as well. So count all the Xbox accounts, so you stretch out rather quickly. 240 million user accounts in Azure, that's also true, but I don't want to know how many are that accounts. And they serve over 127 countries across the globe. All right. From a compliancy point of view, they are probably the biggest one in having those certifications. Is that important? Me as an IT professional, I couldn't care less. But you know, if my enterprise stores data somewhere, they want to know about this compliancy. A lot of these compliances, you're not gonna know what they mean, but that's okay because a lot of them are US-based only. A few that are important for us is FIPS, ISO, HIPAA is pure US, and of course this one, the European Commission compliancy as well. Looking at security, one of the things they're looking at is Key Vault to store keys, virtual networking, the network security groups, and we'll talk about that, but that's basically firewall rules with a fancier name. Virtual private networking, encryption, express route, and security center. Security center is something new. I was surprised that they actually asked me to talk about this one because it's still in beta. What this is going to do is, and for some reason, there is something there. Oops. Let me quickly see if I can fix that. Here we go. That's better. If we're going to look at it, it is going to give you some possibility to work with all of these knowns. I mean, I think Trend Micro, F5, Fortinet, you all know them. They're going to be able to work together with Azure, which means everything will happen today in your data center, which you're using, F5, Fortinet, Jupiter, Barracuda, and so on. And you will have that same functionality in Azure as well. It's still in beta. You can test it out already, but it's coming in production a little bit later. That also means you will have a full view of what is happening security-wise in one simple thing, bringing everything together. That is probably something you can't do on premises today. Most of us probably don't have a management solution that shows me the threats of antivirus, malware, firewall alerting, logging, those kind of things. They will bring it all together in that one view. So that can be interesting, especially for your security guys. If you have those in your environment, you should let them play with this, but it's still beta. So keep that also in mind. All right, let's look at compute and storage. Let's just, first few slides, let me go over it because this is more advertising, marketing, as you want to say it. They claim to have the most flexible compute option. It is true that they're supporting their Windows, obviously, but quite a few Linux flavors as well. And you still have the potential to bring your own Linux flavors also, although that not always works. You can create one virtual machine with 32 processors and 448 gigabytes of RAM. That's a huge machine. But you will pay for it as well. The $100 you just got won't last long with that virtual machine. And then you have standard storage, you have SSD storage. We'll go a little bit deeper in that as well, okay? For storage, multi-tenant, meaning you won't be able, if you have storage, it might be that you're at the exact same storage as your neighbor, but you won't be able to see it from each other, luckily, because that would be a breach. And by default, you always have local redundancy. What does it mean? Let's say we've got a data center in Ireland. Anybody knows where the second data center of Europe is? Very good. Amsterdam. So imagine you deploy your virtual machine right here. Automatically, your, let's call it VHD, will be deployed 3 times in that same data center. Of course, if this data center goes down, you still got nothing. Pay some more money, and you can use geo-redundancy, which means 3 more copies at another location. And in fact, what not many people know is that you've got Ireland 1 and you've got Ireland 2. You've got Amsterdam 1 and Amsterdam 2 as well. So there are, even there, they have split of different data centers. If you're going to talk about the premium storage, you can actually make 5,000 IOPS per disk. That's a lot. Forget about the idea of we need 1 million IOPS for an application. 5,000, take a couple of those disks, bring them together, and you can start calculating. But there are limitations. there are still quite a few limitations. We'll come back to those ones. If you're going to look at the virtual machine, what we see is we've got a C drive, 127 gigabyte. Is that thin provisioned in Azure? You won't notice it, but trust me, they're not giving you 127 gigabyte each virtual machine. You got a disk cache, but you also have a D drive. Do keep in mind that D drive can be very challenging to put some data on it. Do a reboot, all that information is gone. So keep that in mind. But you might be able to use it temporarily for logging or those kind of things. And that drive will be on a Azure blob, right? And then you can actually add data disks up to 1 terabyte, and make it, you know, like you traditionally have a your server, E drive, F drive, and so on, and they will be stored on that blob as well. How many people, how many disks are on that blob? I have no idea. Could be a lot, but I don't know how large their blobs are actually. From a redundancy point of view, where I talked about these three copies, this is literally what they do. You have a rack, and they will make sure that your virtual machine is on another rack, which is exactly the same thing. Meaning, you know, probably not the real life, but imagine you've got an Intel i5, something like that, running here. Then your virtual machine, your copy, will be also on an Intel i5. Is this an i7? Will be an i7. Now, I say i5 and i7, I don't think it works like that over there, but I hope you understand what that means. From a geo replication, this is what they do. When you're gonna choose geo replication, there is going to be more than 400 miles between the data centers. How they do it that fast? Well, they have fiber between all of their data centers, so they have that capacity. We can't afford it, unfortunately, but this is how they do. And they also work east-west. The problem is, I do not know which one is east and which one is west. That is something they keep for themselves. Maybe some people know, but I don't know. And the last thing, what I wanted to give you before we start diving even more, is resource groups. And resource groups, and we is actually the V2, right? I'm going to try to explain that a little bit better by drawing. Now, if we had the V1 model, the first match, what you're going to do was you're going to create a virtual machine. And that virtual machine was somewhere in a cloud service. That is how they call it. That cloud service had one external IP. We got an internal IP. Maybe there was a secondary virtual machine. You could have a load balancer, you could have some things, and you got some storage. And you basically could deploy that very easily, click, 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 next, next, make some names, finished, and it started to run. You came from here, and then you had here what was called endpoints, or the firewall rules. That would make sure that if you RDP, that it would go here, or PowerShell remoting, and so on. Rather easy, very simple. But that apparently was too simple, so they changed it. What they created is called the resource groups. And the resource groups, you have to look at like this. So we've got one resource group, and we're going to give it a name. Workload A, something. And then let's say that workload requires 3 virtual machines, typical 3-tier website, middle-tier database, right? While you still can go to Azure and deploy it exactly the same way as V1, next, 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 it rather becomes confusing because you have to take a lot of decisions. And the reason for that is that now into Azure, and again, coming on-premises as well, you have to start thinking into resources. Now, if you want to deploy a virtual machine, what do you need? This is the moment, start shouting. I know you had lunch, come on. No. Compute, right? We need CPU, we need memory, all right. What else? Storage, yes. What else? Very good. But what you need for networking? And this is where the confusion comes from, by the way. Yes, you need networking, but what you need for networking? You need an IP. You need to have an IP, you need to connect it to a network card. That network card needs to be connected to a switch. That switch needs to be connected maybe to a load balancer. That load balancer needs to be connected to a external IP, and that external IP needs to be connected to the internet. So instead of thinking as a virtual machine as a whole, you suddenly get all different small resources that you're gonna have to start connecting to each other before you have a virtual machine. And this is how you're going to look at a resource manager. I'll go a little bit more in depth on that one a little bit later. Let me first continue here. Scale up. If you ever went to Azure, you will see that when you deploy a new virtual machine, you have to make a choice from a cheap virtual machine to a very, very, very pricey virtual machine per month. And you have all these crazy names like A, D, G, whatever else they had. Today we have D version 2, which is faster than D. It's got different, that's probably where I got the Intel thing off. And now we actually have Ents as well. So there's a lot of difference in it, and one of the biggest difficulties is going to be, what do I need? So let me just skip this one. The Ent family, by the way, is if you need virtual machines that support RDMA capability or high computing. Hey, HPC, if you want to put that in Azure, you need these machines. But also, for example, if you want to have a workload that really has a lot of graphical power, think, I can't remember the name, those where the architects build their things like that, you're going to need to have an N as well. If you run that on a normal virtual machine, it's not really going to work, okay? Another thing they introduced is premium storage. Premium storage is not the same as a standard storage, which most of us have used before. It's actually SSDs. Now, up to 64 terabyte storage per virtual machine, meaning, and then you can quickly jump back to here, if you chose one of those that support that amount of disks attached to it. For example, the cheapest virtual machine you can find only supports one additional disk. That's one additional terabyte, and that's it, okay? But I said 5,000 IOPS per disk, right? And one disk is 1 terabyte. So 64 disks, actually 63, because your C drive is also a disk. But 63 disks times 5,000 IOPS is a little bit more than 80,000, right? So think about when you're deploying your solution, it's not enough to add another disk, and add 5,000 IOPS. You have per virtual machine a limit, 80,000, end of discussion. You won't go over there. Think about that one. But those disks are, 5,000 IOPS. You can have up to 2,000 megabytes per second bandwidth per virtual machine. That's already rather nice. And you can see with caching and with no caching, okay? So how does it work? We've got the virtual machine, we've got an uncached disk provisioning, virtual machine network provisioning, running on those premium storage blocks. What is below there? SSD. That's it. And then you got a cached disk through SSD. Now, if you have something, you hit it, which is in the cache, then of course you will be way faster. If it's not at the cache, you will see that it will have to jump through the network again inside Azure, which means you have that read-write policy as well. It also means that you need to know what are you going to store on those cache disks. If you're going to put binaries on it from your application, but if you're going to put data on it, you'll probably start to see the benefits. And then you have to think about those scale units. Now, I said that it's difficult to choose whether you want an A, D, V, or whatever else you had. The problem is, if you have chosen, you can scale out. For example, you've chosen A1, and you will say, it's not enough, I can go to A3, that is possible. But not everything is possible. You need to stay within your scale unit. And these are the scale units. So scale unit one, basically the price-wise, the cheapest one, is from A0 to A4. But if you hit with that virtual machine the A4 and you still don't have enough, you can't go to the next scale unit. That means deploy a new one, migrate your workloads. Yeah? And then you can see you got scale unit 2, 3, 4, 5, and then the premium ones. Make sense? So that means before you deploy a workload, think very well on the sizing. Because in the end, the virtual machine on premises, in worst case, you do a shutdown in the evening, you put a lot of additional resources on it, you boot, you're good to go. This would get you into a little bit more problems at a certain point in time, right? Yes?
I think I remembered that you can jump between basic and standard, but it takes a very long time to move between these models. Is that possible, or did I just dream that?
Personally, I don't know it's possible. I have not ever seen or heard that. That doesn't mean it is impossible, trust me. But I didn't know. I really normally stay within my scale units.
Yeah, because then they really had to move everything to another physical.
Yes.
Better hardware, and it took.
Yeah. So whether it's possible or not, well, technically everything is possible, right? Because in the end, those scale units, why do they do that? Because you're going to deploy your virtual machine, and imagine they've got a rack right here. They try to make sure that their hardware is used as much as possible. So if you're in scale unit basic, it will have a rack or server or racks. I'm not sure how that looks like. You got standard, maybe number two or something. So what I assume is if they really want to, they actually storage migrate somewhere else. And that probably explains the downtime. But to be honest, I did not know it was possible. So might be, can't confirm that. Also, think about your storage accounts. most people by default will deploy one storage account and start deploying virtual machines on it. It might not be enough, because if you're going to look at your storage accounts, and there are three types of disks, P10, P20, P30, no idea what the P stands for, nor the numbers, but it's not that important. It is looking at the disk size. The one is 128, which is probably the one you're using for your C drive, which is basically 127 gigabytes. Then you have half a terabyte and you got a full terabyte. And then you can see the amount of IOPS per disks and the throughput per disk, right? Now in the other, you can see some virtual machine size, which we just discussed, the DS1, the GS1, where you have number of CPU cores, number of disks, the bandwidth, and the caching that you can use. Now, if we take one step further, and we're going to calculate, then there are a few things you need to do. Now imagine you've got you want to deploy 5 virtual machines, and you want to say, I want to separate every virtual machine, and I want to have one storage disk attached to it, P30, 1 terabyte for each. Or I want to have one single virtual machine, so I want to attach 5 of those disks together and stripe them or combine them or whatever. Now, if you're going to start calculating, that's 25,000 IOPS. One storage account, where was it? Now I can't see it anymore. Was 20,000. Here we go. Was this one. So that means you need 2 storage accounts. And then, if you continue to calculate, let's say we've got a virtual machine capable of getting 12,000 IOPS per disks. You still need to divide by 20,000, again, multiple storage accounts. Sorry, that was not the idea. And this is just another example. If you want to work with your terabytes, 2 different storage accounts. So for one virtual machine, it's possible that you have, and think again to all of these different resources. Yeah, everything is a resource. You will see the same thing for network cards. It's going to be a resource, which means you can have multiple, you can connect them to different networks, but those networks at his own could be a different resource, could be on a different account, and so on and so forth. Same thing with storage, multiple storage accounts. Now, I talked about this one. Those different copies, can't remember, was it here? Yes, Amsterdam, Ireland. So you got locally redundant, everything within the same data center. Yeah, zone redundant, three copies of data across multiple data centers, but within the regions. Then we got GRS, which means 400 miles, over 400 miles difference. And then there's something else which you can use as well as read access redundant storage. It's a little bit cheaper. What does it mean is you're going to replicate the data over here. It's going to be read-only, which means it is not workable, it's not bootable, or you cannot store something on it as long as this one is active. Only when this one is down, then this can become available. Okay? It's a little bit cheaper than have that GRS. On the other hand, GRS can give you another advantage because those copies can work in conjunction, which means if I'm closer to here, I will go here, and if you're closer to here, you will go here. So from your workload point of view, that can save you or can make it a little bit faster. That temporary drive, I already talked about it, the D drive, it's down. It will be dead, emptied when you reboot or shut down that virtual machine. But there are ways of using that disk. SQL temp database, for example, buffer pool, and those kind of things. You can do some stuff with it. It's there, it's your storage. You can use it. This is the performance, but you're all going to get the slides, so I don't have to stay that long on it. And then important is what we call the service manager, because I've been talking 2 storage accounts, and then 20 virtual machines become 50 storage accounts, and that amount of virtual machines, and this amount. What actually do we have within one subscription? There are limitations, and there are quite a few limitations as well. For example, if you're going to look at one subscription, you can only create or add 120 operations in a 5-minute window. Now, this is rather fast. Of course, with PowerShell, you would be able to do 200 adds within that 5-minute window, because it just fires it up. But it's a limitation, and you're going to see quite a few of these limitations as well. If we going to look, for example, here, and you can see that you can only deploy 20 cores, CPU cores, per subscription. That's not a lot. Of course, you see that there's also a maximum limit, which means if you've got the right contract with Microsoft, you can go way above it. But the amount of co-administrators is unlimited. The amount of storage accounts is 100 per subscription. What we see already now is enterprises that have multiple Azure subscriptions too. Can you go over that 100? Yes, but again, that's a special contract with Microsoft. Yeah. The amount of APIs, reads and writes, you can see here as well. Is that important? Yes, if you're going to build automation, you need to keep that in mind. Now, 15,000 reads per hour is rather good. 1,200 writes per hour seems a lot, but you can get there rather quickly, actually. Depends on what type of solution you're building. Per availability set, remember that one rack and the other rack picture you saw? Maximum 100 per dose. And then you have, per standard storage account, 20K IOPS. Okay? So there are limitations. If you're going to start deploying largely, you have to keep a few things in mind. Deploy them in blocks, so not everything at the same time. Make sure you have a good subscription before you start. And limit the use of your APIs as well. Okay? It's just a few things that you need to do. If you want to test what your subscriptions are doing, IOMeter is still the best way of testing. I have no idea how old that tool is. yeah, too old, but it still is being used and it still works and it still will tell you what you're doing, right? Sorry? No. Some other types of storage we have, that's Azure File Storage. How do you have to see that? Because there's a lot of confusion around it. Almost running out of paper. It's a file share. It's basically a file share. What you're going to do is you got a virtual machine, and then on some Azure storage, you're going to create a something file share. That share has limitations as well. I believe it's 1 terabyte per share, or is it 2? No, it's 1 terabyte, I think, per share. It works on SMB3, and you can connect that to a virtual machine or to another virtual machine, and even on premises. Yeah. Don't think this is a wow solution if you're thinking in the name of speed. If you're going to copy files from on-premises to that share, to then distribute it, a lot of coffee will be necessary before it's done. But it is a possibility, yeah? You can do that through the portal. There's a file explorer type of tool that you can use. And of course, REST APIs, PowerShell, those kind of things you can use also. So this is the idea. You have on-premises data over SMB3 protocol to a data center. And then even in another data center, they can access that file share as well. But think about speeds and networking. It's not that fast. True, but it does, it is encrypted. Yeah, then, yeah, no. It's just literally get your data somewhere else. For example, this would not be a solution saying I put my database on that file share and then a virtual machine connect to that database. It just won't work. So, good. Let's continue a bit about networking. We kind of had storage. And then Azure Virtual Networking. How should I see that? Bring your own network. The idea behind Azure Networking is that whatever IP range you are using, you can bring that to Azure, internal IP. It's not that you have external IP range that you can bring that to Azure as well. Although I would not be surprised if at a certain point in time that would be possible. Here we go. If you're going to look at from a, how does it look on-premises, how does it look in Azure, it's more or less the same. The thing is, they start using different names. For example, we use firewall. We use load balancers, right? Suddenly in Azure, you are going to create a network security group, previously called endpoints, just to make it easy. But in the end, everything you do on-premises, you can bring to Azure as well. You want to have those firewall rules, you can build them. If you're working in that Azure Resource Manager, this is just another resource. So you build a couple of rules, and you're going to say, this set of rules, I deploy it to this and this and this resource. But this resources, I need another set of rules, and so on and so forth. There are load balancers as well. Azure automatically has a DNS server that you can use. Do you prefer to use your own DNS server? You can do that as well. But you need to select that and then configure it to use it. Or you can use the one of Azure. Let's see. Load balancing. Okay. What used to be so in the classic model was that you had one public IP per cloud service. If it had 5 virtual machines in it, you still had one public IP for those 5 virtual machines. And then you did RDP to 3389, 3390, 3391, and so on and so forth. In Azure Resource Manager, you're going to see that every virtual machine will get its own public IP. Don't ask me how many public IPs Microsoft has bought, but they have them. It also means that if you're going to work with the load balancing, and that's then called the VIP, not sure where the V stands for in the load balanced, but virtual IP? Oh, thank you. I did not know that. Here you go. That can be a completely different one, which means that your customers, your end users, the people that are using your service will be able to use that VIP, come in over there, and then be divided to one of the virtual machines. But you, for working, can go straight to your virtual machines as well, as long as you know those numbers, of course. All right. And then you have something which is called reserved IPs. Important to know is that when you have an IP connected to that virtual machine, and you would delete that virtual machine or shut down or whatever you're doing, and you build a new virtual machine, you cannot have that IP again. You get just another one. If you want that, you have to work with reserved IPs. That means if you have a reserved IP and you want to go to the second or an updated or whatever else cloud service, then it can follow. But you need to have that upfront. So again, you're looking at all of these little things that you need to know upfront and you need to deploy. Confusing, right? To be honest, it is confusing. For the DNS, by default, you will see something cloudapp.net. And it also means if you deploy a service, you need to find a name. For example, I believe for me it's Veeam-SP, but it needs to be unique. On the other hand, you can bring your own DNS names as well and use those. Because I think if you're going to offer a service to customers, you don't want it to be called cloudapp.net. You probably want to have your own DNS name. But that is perfectly possible as well. How does it work when you scale up and scale down? That's rather important and actually rather handy. So let's say you've got a service, the internet, very badly cloud. You've got your load balancer, and you got two virtual machines. Let's just say websites to make it easy. If you're going to go scale up, you can quickly deploy a new one, and the load balancer will take care of everything else. If you want to scale down, you delete it, or you shut it down, depending on your needs, and the load balancer will take care of it. Everything will be done for you. At this point in time, especially if you're going to use something like that, a virtual machine is still slow to be deployed and start up, and containers will probably be here what you want to use if you're in that situation. How is the deregistration for DNS and those kind of things? Automatically, you don't have to care for that. That is not your problem. And then if you want to, you can also create your own routes, because what will happen is Azure will give you private IPs, will give you public IPs, and will do the routing completely itself. If you're not happy with that routing, you can use UDR, user-defined routes, to build your own routes. Why is that? Well, for example, imagine that you're building a rather large service and you've got a front end and you've got a back end, different subnets. By default, you will see internet comes in. This one is connected, the front end needs to serve. And then from the front end, there will be a route to a back end. If you don't like that and you, for example, want to work with IP forwarding, you can actually deploy a VM appliance and use that to do the routing yourself and to make it differently. Are you going to use it? Depends on your workload, I should say, but it is perfectly possible. Okay. How does it work with virtual NICs in any Azure virtual machine? Exactly the same thing as on premises. You can add per virtual machine 1, 2, 3, I believe up to, I'm not sure, 8? I can't remember how many virtual NICs you can actually attach to it. And then choose your routing, choose your different subnets, and build a management network, a backup network, a deployment network, a I don't know what type of network, and the one that goes to the internet. So you can do that perfectly as well within Azure. That also means that the portability from here, from on-premises to here, should be guaranteed. However, do keep in mind, again, each of those will be a resource. That means each of those networks, subnets, will need to be built as well. If it requires gateways, you need to create those. Step by step, resource by resource. Oh yeah, how many NICs per virtual machine? How about 16? It was actually on the slide, so that's good. NSG is that network security group. So you can literally say, I built my rules, and for each NIC, I have different type of rules, which is, of course, logical if you work with different networks, okay? What about your connectivity? If you really want to be serious about this model, the hybrid model, you want to connect your on-premises environment through a VPN to Azure. We call that extend the data center. The problem is that connectivity. If you're going to do it over a VPN, purely on your internet line that you have today, it's probably not going to be enough. Unless you have some serious bandwidth at your office, but even then, it's rather far away. Ireland, Amsterdam, it's not that good. If you're thinking about really extending it, then you probably want to look into that express route. That speeds things a lot up, but that means you're going to have to work together with one of those providers that offers express route. To be honest, in Belgium, I have no idea which they are. I'm pretty sure they exist, but I have no idea. I know in other countries it's the major telecom operators that play on it. And BT? BT is one of them, yeah. O3? See? Colt? See, we are here already. Bellnet? Proximus? See, there will be enough express route for everyone in a couple of months. But it's... The difference is huge. If you really are serious about this and you're extending your data center, it's almost impossible to say, I'm going to go purely on my internet line. Don't forget what you're normally doing in a LAN. You're suddenly extending over one. Then this is probably not going to work. So keep that certainly in mind when you want to architect something like that. Your VPN gateways. If you're going to look at the throughput, if you have a standard VPN gateway SKU in Azure, a basic one, 500 Mbps, not possible to coexist with ExpressRoute, 100 Mbps, maximum IPsec tunnels, and the cost per hour. Now, $0.04 is not that expensive, but you do also pay, of course, for that VPN. And then depending on what you need, you're going to see, of course, not only a price increase, but also an increase on performance. 2,000 Mbps with express routes and so on. So keep that in mind. Right, very important. O365 Skype for Business, if you're running that in the cloud, and you have express route for it, it's a combination, then you don't need that virtual network gateway. That is, I was going to say, comes free of a charge, but nothing comes free as a charge. In the end, you still have to pay for the express route to start with. But then you don't need it. But this is for those 0365, those type of businesses. That's not important, okay? All right. I'm almost there. Here we go. How does it work on a security approach? Because, you know, I've been talking here, extending data center, moving workloads to the cloud. What about security? What is the control we have over security? You might be surprised how many control you have. And if there are holes in Azure, it's probably because you misconfigured something. Because in the look, what they offer you is DDoS. That is their thing, and they're good at that. Whatever they're doing, it won't be easy for somebody to attack your workload running in Azure. Then you got ACLS, that's going to be your responsibility. If you give access to your service to the entire world, well, then you have your virtual network isolation. I already said it, it's not you bring in 192.168.1, you doing the same thing, it's completely isolated. You can't attach each other's networks, you can't attach each other's storage, that's not possible. And then you have those network security groups. And network security groups, well, it's like the firewall on premises, right? The amount of people that say, oh, I need to test something out, something is not working, let's just open star to star. And then leave it like that. And then pretty stupid, but probably most of us aren't using it, but a Windows firewall exists in every Windows server. You might make fun of it and saying that's something for a Windows 10 device, but in reality, that's a rather powerful firewall. If you can, I see no reason whatsoever not to use it. Is it the best type of firewall? No, that's actually happening on this ring, right? But just making sure that you have your security therein as well is just another layer of security, which you can't just by default say, I don't need that firewall. It's another layer. And you're playing in a public space, so every layer is going to be important. All right, for the network security groups, they can be applied at the virtual machine or the subnet. Okay? So think about if you're working with multiple NICs, yeah? If they're attached to different subnets, you're going to have different rules. But also know if you got two NICs that are connected to the same subnet, then of course it's only one set of firewalls. On the other hand, if you're going to connect two NICs to the same subnet on one virtual machine, it's probably not because you want separation or data or the rules or something like that. Yeah. And then we're at the point of resource manager. But before I actually go into there, because that's the deployment part, let me quickly jump and show you a few things to, you know, get rid of that slides thing. Let's see. All right. Let me quickly. No, I can't. I can't change. I can't shift. Okay. This is the new portal, right? And I said, if you really want to, you can still go to, let's see. You can choose an image, and you can literally work as you did before. Go to a wizard, select everything, and then you're there. But you will have a lot of questions. As I said, you've got the resource manager. You can still use the classic model. However, my advice would be everything you deploy today, don't go to classic model anymore. I doubt they are still developing on it. They want to get rid of it. There is a way to convert your classic virtual machines to the resource manager virtual machines, but it requires a PowerShell script that you can download from GitHub and offline. It's not possible online today. So keep that in mind. And then when you create it, you're going to have a lot of questions. So let's just say quickly, create. You got your basics. Tests. By the way, administrator as a username is not possible. And using the standard Microsoft password, which they use in every lab, is not possible. So I need to choose something else. Then you got your subscription. You can see I have a Visual Studio subscription. And then you're going to start by building or selecting your resource group. So let me just create test resource group. Here we go. I'm going to choose my location. I have Northern Europe. The reason why I have Northern Europe is my storage account is over there. I still don't have one in Western Europe, but that's something I should fix at a certain point in time. And then you're going to choose your size, and these are the scale units I talked about. And this is also always a great question. What is slow, Azure or the internet? And then he tells you, of course, to recommend, and it's actually loading the pricing as well. This pricing, by the way, is not correct. If they say it costs something like 100 euros per month, don't expect 100 euros a month. It depends on what you're going to do with it. Can be more, can be less as well. It's more or less. But you can say view all, and you will see that there is indeed a lot of things. Just to show you, where was it? There is somewhere, see, there's already a virtual machine here, D14. That's around 1,000 euros a month without doing something, just, you know, deploy and running. If you attach a few disks additionally to it, you can see the price going up. This is my favorite, the A0, this price, especially with those free accounts, you know. So I can choose this, select. And then you have to make all of these decisions. What storage are you going to use? Now, since I use the A0, you will see premium won't work for me. It's just not possible. You're going to have to check or select your storage account. And then you need to make all of your decisions. Virtual network, public IP address, network security groups, all of these things. Now, as you can see, when I go through the wizards, because then I've got availability as well, it doesn't make sense to me, to be honest. Why do I need to choose all of these things? Why are we creating? Because you can see new here everywhere. I can reuse, of course. Because in the end, what you have to think about, and let me quickly jump right back. Where's my mouse pointer? Yay, PowerShell. Quickly see where I've stored this one. That's a good question. Where did I store it? Ah, here we go. This is the PowerShell I use to deploy a virtual machine from zero into Azure Resource Manager. But I literally start by creating, well, some of them are blanked out if I want to reuse, by using that. Let me just draw it out to make it as clear as possible. First thing I need to have is that resource group, that thing where everything is going to be as the box of different resources, right? Then I literally say, well, I need a storage account. A storage account where I basically already took a decision on the location and whether I want that geographically redundancy, the local redundancy. You can see me using in green standard LRS because that's the cheapest one, which is only local one. After I've got that, what I do here is I actually create my subnet. Another resource. Then I'm using a virtual network. That virtual network is going to be connected to that subnet. Then you see me creating a public IP address. So we're going to get here a IP, 143 dot something. Azure is going to give me that. Then I actually make a network controller card. And I also make sure I've got an IP address, a private IP address, which, then I believe 10.1 something, I attach to that network controller card. When I have that, I'm gonna start building my configuration. This is a simple virtual machine, by the way. This is not even attached to a load balancer. This is not even different routes. This is literally the basics. And then I create a virtual machine and I'm gonna have to build my config file. And just to show you, if I'm gonna scroll down a bit, my config file has a size, has a name, has some parameters for which operating system, has a publisher name. That is because I want to use one of the templates that exists in that marketplace or in the Azure as well. Then I make sure I've got my OS disks with a name connected to a specific specific storage account. I've typed it out here, but you can actually script that in parameters as well. Then I add a NIC, and I'm gonna put it at a certain location, Northern Europe, Western Europe, US, something else. And then I finally, in the end, actually do a little query to see what my IP address, so I can attach it. But you can see we are all creating little Lego building blocks and then put it together into one virtual machine. Can you still go through the wizard and do this one by one? Yes, you just saw that it is possible. And then at that point in time, just keep in mind you're all creating these different things, which means if you deploy in the RM one virtual machine, next, you select everything, you let deploy, then you're gonna go for a second one. He might be you creating a second storage account. He might create multiple subnets, multiple virtual networks, and you might think, I've got two virtual machines in one resource group, why aren't they talking to each other? Well, you are separating them. Because the second virtual machine, you can reuse a subnet, you can reuse the virtual network, and of course, the storage account. It's difficult, right? It's again one of these things that you have to work with. Now, back to this one. Okay, let me just forget about this and go to my resources. Let's see. What would be the best to show? I think this one. Yes. The easiest way actually to discover how these resources work and what you're deploying is just actually do what I did, create that virtual machine, let it be deployed, and then go and check in your resource group what you have built. And you can see I've got a network, I've got security rules right here. This one, these are my, if it wants to load, my security rules. This is the network, this is the virtual machine, this is the network card. Public IP address, and the storage account. Now, if it wants to open my security rules, I would be able to show you how that works. So this is the network security group, and you will see there are inbound security rules, there's outbound. You can see what network card it's connected to which subnet it's working. But if I'm gonna go to inbound, you can see that the two ports I am using and which are open is Windows Remote Management to be able to do PowerShell directly to my virtual machine, and my default RDP port. And this is, of course, your responsibility to create more, less, multiple, and so on. Does this mean, by the way, by default, if my virtual machine would run a web server that you can connect to it? Nope. That port is not open. So keep that in mind when you start deploying. On the other hand, if you're going to work with a load balancer, you probably want to open port 80 or 443, depending on your service, to that load balancer, and then internally go further. What time is it? I'm more or less on schedule. All right. Why did they make it so difficult? Or what is the reasoning behind it? Well, it's to make sure that you can deploy exactly same way. Because if you're gonna look at Azure Resource Manager, the idea for deployment is to do exactly the same thing as you would be doing on premises. what might look difficult, in the end, you will see a little bit later on with templates, you can do exactly the same. Now, that means, of course, Azure Command Line Visual Studio. Now, as an IT professional, you would say, Visual Studio, are you kidding me? That's for developers. Sorry. Even for developers, start getting used to this type of things. The day that an IT pro only did infrastructure, and if something needed to program, then it was, hey, developers, help me out here, those days are over. Other way around as well, by the way. Developers, only coding is done as well. They're going to have to start understanding these types of things as well. Officially, they call this DevOps or something, which is a fancy word, and nobody can really explain what it is. But be aware that in our job, things are going to change, and purely infrastructure point of view is not going to be enough anymore. I know you probably don't want to hear this on a Monday, but it is what it is. Also important is that with that new type, that Azure Resource Manager, and think about that Azure stack as well, they're going to be providers, resource providers. You have compute, storage, networking providers. Most of those resource providers in V1 and in V2 are exactly the same, besides the ones that are mostly interesting for us, compute, storage, and networking. Means if you have development against the V1's APIs, that changes completely. If you're going to start development against them today, don't start with the V1's. All right. So this is that classical model, right? Virtual machine with that IP address, load balanced endpoint, connected to a storage account to a virtual network, and this is then that resource manager. Actually, I should have used this one, but you can see all of the references in between and how all of these little things are small resources combined to each other. Then you can start using templates. Templates meaning I can roll out a workload that exists out of certain type of settings based on all the different resources. Now, this is their example. SQL, website, virtual machine, dependencies, and so on. But if you're going to look at it, and this is, of course, use cases, more important, is it's not that difficult to start with if you use the examples. Don't say, I'll jump into Visual Studio and start typing. If you can do that, give me a call. I would like to hire you. What I did was literally went to those quick start examples, download a few, and start reading them. Is it difficult the first time? Yes. But then it's rather easy. Who of you knows GitHub? You're not allowed to speak. I know you. You, at least a few things. GitHub is probably more known by developers than it is by IT professional. But GitHub is certainly something as an IT professional you have to look at as well. A lot of these examples, a lot of these templates are literally on there. Microsoft puts them on. But there's a lot of community people that just put their own templates as well, which you can just download and use free repositories. Remember, Microsoft is more and more into, think about Docker, think about those repositories, think about the open source work they're all doing. I mean, SQL Server on Linux, who would have guessed that a year ago? And they're using those tools as well to start distributing images and so on. Because when you're going to create a template, you're going to use JSON. Now, JSON is indeed one of these things that say, yeah, where's my developer? Just to give you a few examples. You start by making schema. What is schema? You need to have a number, a content version. Then you're going to create parameters where you can see, for example, that one of them is my DNS name. The other one is going to be my administrator username, even a password if you want to. Although it does say secure string here while typing it, people will be able to read it. You can see all the variables, and this should ring a bell. Location, West US or Northern Europe. Image publisher. I can actually show you that how you can find that in Azure. It's not that difficult, but you need to know it. So let me come back on that one in a couple of minutes. What's your disk name, nicknames? So you're going to make your service a template. Again, the first time I didn't even thought about writing it myself. I literally downloaded some examples and started to learn. And even now today, what I still do is I start from an example and then just modify it. Because there's no way I can remember these things. But that also means, because of the way it works, and you can see some more examples here, which resources you're gonna use, and so on, that you can also start working with parameters, which means you can create in Azure Stack or in Azure, and you're gonna say, okay, I wanna deploy a new virtual machine. Let's say you built the template, and I always choose you for some reason, sorry about that. You are going to want deploying, and you will want to customize it. You're a developer, you wanna say, I want this and this and this. When you build a template, you're gonna work with parameters. And in that JSON file, you're gonna give him the possibility to change a few parameters. Could be the location, could be the name, could be the admin, user, you know, those kind of things. You're gonna choose it. But in the end, you're literally going to create a template. And if you think it from that way, and you think about SCCM, for example, or any other tool that you use today to deploy stuff, it's more or less the same. Besides the fact that it's using JSON. Why JSON? Probably because everybody else uses the same thing. So, if you have one of those custom JSON files, how is it gonna look in Azure Stack and in Azure? Just like that. You have it embedded, and then you see their custom template, and because of the parameter passing, your end user will be able to choose the admin username, the password, the DNS name, the location, the OS version, and the size of the disk. And everything else will be deployed through your template. Yeah? That also means, coming back to this, that you will be able to deploy entire resource groups based on one JSON file. It doesn't have to be one VM, it can be a set of different resources that then come together into one service. What else as advantage does it have? If you then have this resource, and that is the big difference with a classic model, you can update everything at the same time. If there need to be changes, if there's a newer version, if there's whatever. In the classical model, if you want to update, you could update VM first, next VM, storage account, networking, downtime, oops, and so on. So this is more the service model that comes together in Azure. All right, if you want to use PowerShell, of course, and with passing parameters, that can do as well, okay. What type of tools can you use? GitHub, again, very important, bit confusing in the beginning, but there's a lot of examples. Visual Studio, or our big favorite, Notepad and Notepad++. They still work, still great stuff. Let's see. This is about GitHub, 27.6 million repositories of code. If you don't find your example there that you need, I wonder what you're deploying, and I would like to know. This is open community, just create some and you're good to go, right? Visual Studio, for those developers out here or in your teams, has integration with Git as well. And then, of course, you got your Azure. Stuff. No, this is for something else, sorry. I should have not showed that. Oops. Okay. With that, let me try to recap a bit, because this is, let's just say I lost a lot of sweat over understanding ARM the first time they ever explained it to us. Wasn't that easy. In the end, what you have to think about is when you're going to create a resource group, what you do is you create a big box. Can you say this is also a service? Yeah. I mean, in the end, everything which is going to be in here will be managed the same way and can be done. And then you deploy your resources, but instead of thinking a server, you have to think about, I've got compute, I've got an image running on it, I've got a network card, I've got a private IP, I've got a public IP, I might have a load balancer, I might have some gateways, I've got a subnet, and so on, and so on, and so on. If you want to do this into Azure itself, you can go through that wizard, or you can say, for example, where's the mouse pointer again? Here we go. Plus, and you can say, well, I would like to create a virtual network gateway, a network security group for my rules, or simply, well, I want to create a NIC. Nothing more to it. See, you can use a network interface, security group. So you can do all of these little parts one by one and then combine everything. Speaking of these images, I did promise you something. If I can find it back. Here we go. Finding those images and the publisher can be difficult. In the Azure portal, you literally see them and they have a common name. But if you want to connect through to PowerShell, that name, of course, is not the same. So let me quickly see where it is. Here we go. Am I okay? Yeah. So what are you going to do is by using PowerShell and you're going to connect to Azure, you're going to log into your account first, of course, and then you're going to have to find the specific image name. What you need to know for that, that's the location, because not every image will be available at every location. Some images, for whatever reason, I don't know, is only available in that region. Language is one of them, but we've seen that in US they have more images than in Europe, and we don't know the exact reason for that. You need to have the publisher name. If you think, oh, Microsoft Windows Server, I've got the publisher for everything Microsoft does, no. You will see Microsoft, you will see Microsoft Windows Server, they have a lot of different publishers. Then what offer, what SKU, and what version? All of this you need to know before you can do this automation of deploying a virtual machine. How do I find it? Well, I first say, give me Azure RM, RM standing for Resource Manager, Virtual Machine Image Publisher, and give me everything which exists in Northern Europe. If I've got this, then give me everything with a certain publisher name, because you will get a full list. And then step by step, I continue until I found that specific data. Now, pure from an automation point of view, what you would do is every time store everything in a variable, and then read those out until you find exactly what it is. This is, again, something just do it once, twice. It's not that really hard, but you need to do it. And with that, I'm going to end the live screen, stream, sorry about that. Thank you very much for watching. The rest of us will continue with doing some labs. I hope you enjoyed it. And for us, we are going to continue a bit working on the labs.